We're here at the grant writing workshop for the National Institute of Food and Agriculture, and I think I may have NIFA employees outnumbering our audience. Today I've got myself, Dr. Nancy Grohlke, Nancy Cavallaro, Marianne Rossum, and Dennis Ibadagi, and Karen Grubb, here with us. So one of the key things for understanding grant process is knowing who's in our agency. Take a look at those tags. Everybody wears these tags. You can talk to anybody in our agency about grant programs. Our agency is the major extramural funding agency at USDA. Our budget is a little over $1 billion. About $500 million of that goes out in competitive grants each year. The National Institute of Food and Agriculture is divided into four institutes and one center. We've got an Institute for Food Production and Sustainability, Food Safety and Nutrition, Institute for Bioenergy, Climate and Environment, and Youth, Family, and Communities. We also have a Center for International Programs, although our mission really is about U.S. agriculture. Here's what the flowchart looks like. I think there's a handout there, so you can take a look at that. I'm the Division Director for Bioenergy, Sustainable Bioenergy. Now, what sort of things does the National Institute of Food and Agriculture support? Well, if you're at a land-grant institution, we support you at a land-grant institution. We're the home for the land-grant institution. A lot of our money goes out in what's called formula funds. So if you have a hatch project, you're funded by us. That's in the research side. We also support education. We have several programs dedicated to education. A lot of our funding goes to education programs. And extension. So this is extension and outreach to achieve tangible results from the knowledge that's been gained through research. Of course, we're part of the Department of Agriculture. We're created from the old Cooperative State Research, Education, and Extension Service, which it took me about 8 years to learn how to say real fast. And now we are the National Institute of Food and Agriculture, which more clearly, I think, communicates our mission to the public and others. We're really about a national mission related to food and agriculture. In the past, our old name, people saw themselves in our immediate partnership, saw themselves in the name because they would say, yes, I do extension or I do research, and that's in the name. But it was not really clearly communicating to the public. Our largest competitive program is the Ag and Food Research Initiative. Now, what I've got in this presentation is about the next 50, 60 slides describe a whole series of competitive programs that we have. We're different from other funding agencies that tend to get their funding in large blocks. The ag community, different segments of the ag community have lobbied quite a bit for attention to particular areas, and Congress has responded by creating a whole series of separate individual programs. Some of these programs are targeted on particular commodities, so you'll see things like potato research or the Specialty Crops Research Initiative. Others are targeted at building capacity among certain institutions, so you'll see an 1890 for the historically black land-grant colleges, special programs for those or for Hispanic-serving institutions, and et cetera. So you really have to explore our agency's offerings, and I think one of the other handouts was a sort of a snap from our webpage about current open programs. Really, you need to explore on our webpage and find which programs might best serve your needs or fit with your institution. Now let's see how fast I can go through these slides. You're getting all this, right? What I really want to spend some time on today is understanding the review process at the National Institute of Food and Agriculture and some tips for you as applicants. Everybody always wonders, okay, there were all those programs that, of course, you memorized as they went by. And, I'm going to work on my application, do a good job, but then what happens to it once I submit it? What happens to this application? How are they evaluated? Who's making these decisions? And, why isn't a better job done because I wasn't funded? Again, we'll talk about the four institutes, but they all basically use the same evaluation criteria. We have a set working team that sets the standards for our review process. I'm going to talk a little bit about the overall process, competitive grant process. So we'll talk about the application process, the review process, awards and declines. Remember, you want to get, we award grants, and rather than saying that you weren't funded or you were rejected, we like to sort of try and cushion the blow and say that we are declining to fund your particular application. And a little bit, a very little bit, about post-panel administration and how that works, and post-award administration and how that works. Let's talk about the application process. Remember, for us, you apply to us because we are a mission agency. Our mission is defined by Congress, sometimes very narrowly for particular programs. So you really can't propose things outside of what we've been assigned in our mission. That's why for submissions to us, you're always applying to a particular announcement. Now, our requests for applications are posted on our website. There's also a link there at Ed Grants, and there's a printout from the page for you to see. Now, the first step in application for many programs is submitting a letter of intent. It's like a one-page document that you're going to submit. Most programs require this. And it's actually required to submit one so that to allow you to submit a full proposal. Now, we do this to get for a couple of reasons. One is to understand the volume of applications that we're going to get so we can plan on handling that. Second is to get a feel for sort of the range of expertise that will be needed in the panel, see what sort of scope that we're going to have to cover. And the third is to provide you with some advice on how well you're meeting program goals, how well you read the RFA, and how well you included things. So we used to weed out sort of outlier applications at the letter of intent stage and say, we're not going to allow you to apply because you're too off target. Now what we do is we will allow you to apply, but we're going to either encourage you or discourage you. If you get discouraged in your email back about your letter of intent, that means you've missed some key element in the request for applications that is identified as required for success, mandatory for success. Now, of course, you need to develop your application by following the specific program goals and priorities that are listed. You have to pay attention to the deadline as well. No late applications are accepted by the National Institute of Food and Agriculture. Let me say that again. No late applications are accepted. Okay. This last year, we offered some fairly large grants. We offered some grants in the $40 million range. We had one that was 1 minute late. 1 minute late. Not acceptable. Okay. Why do we do this? We do this to be fair. To be fair, everybody gets the same amount of time to plan their project and apply. You have to draw the line somewhere. We put the deadline in there. We tell people about the deadline. We also have other requirements in the RFA to keep it fair. We say that if we say we'll make grants up to a certain level of dollar amount, you can't submit a grant for over that dollar amount. We won't review it because it's not fair. We used to not enforce that, and what would happen is panel would say that, you know, we'll fund proposals up to $300,000. Somebody submits something for $1 million. Well, for $1 million, you can do a lot more than for $300,000. So when it went to the panel, the $1 million one always looked sparkling and would rank very highly. However, how fair was that to the other people who worked to manage their proposal to hit that $300,000 target? So those criteria and guidelines in the RFA are pretty critical. Now, I say we never submit late applications, you know, never say never. If there are sort of acts of God, you know, your university is closed for a hurricane or there's a major snowstorm that shuts down your university, we will accept late applications for those kinds of things. I like the time when the backhoe operator at Mississippi State cut the main fiber optic cable into campus. That was a good one. But we'll want documentation of that, you know, and we document that because we are audited all the time. the General Accountability Office from Congress, as well as the USDA Office of Inspector General, comes down and looks at things. On grants.gov applications, and all our applications come through grants.gov, it stamps a date and a time when your application comes in. So we have to have justification for a late application. Now, one of the things we suggest is 72 hours before is when you need to submit. This is especially true with more complex applications. You'd be surprised who runs into problems. You would think it'd be smaller institutions or institutions that don't apply to us very often. What happens many times is larger institutions get overconfident. They submit a lot of applications to us, and so they start to push it to the edge. And they're trying to, you know, it's a 5 p.m. East Coast time deadline, and they're trying to submit starting at 4:30. They run into a problem, and they can't get it done. Okay, during the review process, you need to be engaged as well. You should contact the NPL if you don't get an email back within 4 weeks saying that we got your application. Okay, you should get a automatically generated. You'll get some stuff from grants.gov, but that's just like, remember, grants.gov serves the function of FedEx, that FedEx did in the old days. They're just the people who are going to deliver things to us. They're going to pick up the package. They check some things in the package, you know, just to make sure you have the pieces. That doesn't mean that there's anything on those pieces or they're done correctly, but they'll just kind of look at that, and then they deliver that to us. So you need to contact and make sure that it got to us. If you don't get a contact back from us, there'll be, it could be there are some issues and that we might need to resolve with grants.gov. You need to keep us informed about changes in your address or a contact information. You know, if we're going to give you a grant, we need to be able to get a hold of you. There's also important things related to conflict of interest. So if you get a new grant that comes in, or you suddenly have an opportunity, you're publishing a paper with some folks that's new, we need to hear about that, because those would all be related to conflict of interest in the review of your proposal. We can't have somebody that is publishing with you or got funded with you on the review panel and evaluating your proposal. Now, you should then be patient, because it takes time. Remember, we got to get these in. We have to arrange for the panel and get that out, give time for the panel to review things, and then we'll get back to you. The national program leader will send you an email with the estimated timeline on this. So pay attention to that timeline and really try not to bug him until, you know, the timeline has reached that point where he might have answers about the fate of your proposal. Now, we use a competitive peer review process that's been reviewed by the National Research Council of the National Academies, and it was rated very highly by them. It's designed to be scholarly and fair. It's reviewed by peers and other experts as appropriate. They provide both written evaluations through our automated electronic peer review system and verbal evaluations during panel discussions. You need to understand the review process for your specific program to prepare a competitive proposal. The main difference is the program-dependent evaluation factors that are published in the request for application. The tighter you adhere to those, the more success you will have. Now, the review process is co-led by the national program leader and the scientific lead for the National Institute of Food and Ag, and a panel manager. Now, what their role is to organize and conduct the review panel to make sure that it's fair and rigorous and we are finding the best applications that we receive. However, neither the national program leader or the panel manager are to really offer an opinion on any application that comes in. They are not to offer, you know, this one, here's obviously the best one, here's the worst one we got, or anything like that. That's the job of the peer review panel. Well, who is the panel manager? Now, they're an established in the field of science. They can be an educator, scientist, or extension specialist as appropriate for that particular panel. If it's a research panel, of course, there'll be a research scientist. But if it's an integrated activity that might combine research, education, and extension, could be somebody whose primary job is education or extension. There'll be a leader in the field of science that's being evaluated. They'll be knowledgeable about current trends and priorities in the scientific area. And we actually hire these people for 300 hours as a USDA employee to do this. Now, what are the NPL and the panel manager doing? They're studying proposals to evaluate the expertise and needs, you know, for the evaluation. So what kind of scope of expertise do we need on this panel? They invite people to serve on the panel. And then they assign proposals to the panelists. Each panelist or each application gets a minimum of 3 reviews. Now, the panelist number depends on the number of applications that you get to a program. If there's a lot of applications, you know, you need more panelists. There is, however, an upper limit on panel size. You really can't have the panel function well and complete its work within a week with more than about, 150 applications. So sometimes things are split if we get more than 150, or other procedures are undertaken to sort of winnow it down to a manageable number. Now, in addition to panelist reviews, sometimes we'll do ad hoc reviewers. These folks review for us electronically only. They do not attend the panel meeting in Washington, D.C. A lot of times this is done when a special technique is used, special instrumentation, and we want comment on that particular approach, or it's crop species or animal species, something that's very different that's outside the norm or outside what's been generally submitted to the program. And we look to add that expertise for as an ad hoc reviewer. So who's on the panel? Well, we want to look for people who are active in their field. This is code for I don't want somebody who was a great scientist but is now in administration and has been for the last 5 years and hasn't done anything. I want folks who are active in the field. In addition, we want balance in the panel. Well, what do I mean by that? Well, I want balance in the types of disciplines. So, for the panel, the disciplines that are needed. I also want geographic balance. So I don't want everybody from the South. I don't want everybody from the West Coast. In fact, the general rule is any panel will not have more than 2 people from any particular state. In fact, you can only draw 2 people from the state for the larger states. So we'll take 2 people from like Texas and California, perhaps Florida and New York, but we really want to limit it to one state. We want some variability, some variety based on institution size and type. So we won't have all land-grant universities. We won't have all large universities. We'll have some folks from federal labs. We may have some folks from private industry. It all depends. Professional rank. We don't want a panel that's all a bunch of crusty old full professors who are just going to be cranky about most of the applications coming in. Okay, we like new blood on the panel. So we'll look for assistant professors, associate professors, and other people in early stages of their career. And, of course, we're looking for gender and ethnicity diversity on the panel as well. Other things in here that come in, back to the institution type, minority-serving institutions, 1890 institutions, Hispanic-serving institutions, others. One of the other aspects of the panel is we want continuity. So for programs that are long-standing programs that are offered year after year, we'll actually look to have maybe a third of the panel come back every year, although no panelists will serve more than 2 years in a row. This is because for long-standing programs, it's very common to get resubmissions, so a proposal's coming back in, and we want to have people on the panel who've seen that application before and will understand if the applicant has responded well to previous reviews. Now, we're going to assign, say, 20 or so proposals to each panelist. They do get something out of this in that We do pay them an honorarium for the days that they spend in Washington, or if it's a virtual panel, the number of days online or in the video conference for the panel. We will pay for the travel to Washington, D.C. Some panelists use this time to also network with other funding agencies. But it's going to be a lot of work. You're going to be responsible for reviews of 20 proposals. You provide a scientific, constructive, and fair evaluation. You evaluate what's in the application, not what's not in the application. So we don't look for, oh, this guy's a big reputation. This person, she's a member of the National Academy. Well, she always does great stuff. We ought to fund her. Well, no, let's evaluate what's in that application. The role of the panelist also is to protect confidentiality and avoid conflicts of interest. So protecting confidentiality, well, what's confidential? If you're a panelist, all the panelists sign a confidentiality agreement. The content and identity of the proposal and the identity of all applicants is confidential. The identity of the reviewers is confidential. You can identify yourself as participating in the panel, but you cannot identify which applications you reviewed or who else was on the panel. The written reviews are confidential. So that, and they're shared only with the project director or the lead on the application. So if you're part of a team that's submitting an application and the panel's over and you're wondering where the reviews are and you call us because you were a co-investigator, hey, can I get a copy of the reviews? They went to the project director and you have to get them from the project director. Also, what's said in panel stays in panel. Panels like Las Vegas that way. So the panel proceedings, all the discussion about any application is confidential as well. Conflicts of interest. You're in conflict with a proposal for all your grad students if you're an advisor. Any grad student that you supervise, you're in conflict with. In addition, you're in conflict your lifetime for your major professor. So you can't review applications from them. Collaborators and co-authors for the last 3 years you're in conflict with if you're on the panel. You have an institutional conflict, so if you're at if you're at Cornell, you're in conflict with every application from Cornell. You're also in conflict with if you stand to materially profit from any application, that's sort of this fiduciary connection, you're in conflict with that application. There may be also other personal reasons that you identify. We added this in because there's sometimes a familial relationship. Hey, this is an application from my brother who's at Institution X or sister or whatever, and we can't know all about that and match. Sometimes the names don't match. We had the case where we had the husband on the panel and we signed him to review an application by his wife, but they had different last names, so that was a little embarrassing. Now, conflict of interest criteria applies to everybody in the panel, and that includes the national program leader, the panel manager, the panelists, the ad hoc reviewers. They may not participate in any aspect of an evaluation of an application that they're in conflict with. This means that for the physical panel meeting, if you're in conflict with that application, you leave the room. You leave the room, and you're not part of any discussion for that. You also may not participate in any decisions regarding the budget or project scope or duration of the particular project as well. Okay, how are the proposals evaluated? Well, the reviewers prepare written reviews, and they're going to use the evaluation criteria in the request for applications. They're going to write up a review that addresses the strengths and weaknesses of that proposal, and they're going to make suggestions for improvement. Then they're going to provide a individual summary rating. This is all done before the panel meeting online on the web in our peer review system, where they're going to say it's excellent, very good, good, fair, poor. Once they do that, they will get to see the ratings of the other people who were assigned that application. If you're an applicant, what you want to get is all excellence. However, sometimes there'll be split reviews. There'll be good, good, excellent. Excellent, excellent, fair. Excellent, excellent, poor. That means that some reviewers saw things in there that others didn't, and really is the foundation for discussions once we get to the face-to-face meeting in the panel. Well, what are the evaluation criteria? Again, they're different for every program, and they're specified in the request for applications. What I'll do is give you an example from our largest competitive program, the Agriculture and Food Research Initiative. There are three basic criteria: scientific merit, qualifications, and relevance. Well, what's scientific merit? Well, we ask the panel to look and decide whether it's a novel approach, unique, innovative. Is there something new here? For model systems, we want to see that the knowledge is transferred to something of agricultural importance. We understand that a lot of new knowledge can be generated by working with Arabidopsis. However, you've got to remember that we are a mission agency, and the mission is agriculture and food production. So when you make that great breakthrough in Arabidopsis, we want to be able to see that, yeah, that same thing happens in corn or tomato or something that we can tout your finding on up higher in to Congress or to others. We ask for conceptual adequacy of the research and clarity and delineation of objectives. This really gets to how well you're communicating what you're doing. We're looking for a good description and suitability, feasibility of the methods that you've included. Many times this is best done through preliminary data that you've got in there. We also ask the panel to talk about the probability of success. Now, we used to ask the panel just said probability of success. And what happens, especially for programs that have a low funding rate, is the panel got very, very conservative, and they wanted only sure things to be funded. And that's really not how you're going to advance a field. There were lots of panels where the final result was a whole list of applications that sounded like, you know, they had titles like "I Will Shoot Fish in a Barrel Again," you know, kind of things. And we don't want that. So we asked the panel now to weigh the risk and reward in applications. And that's right in the evaluation criteria that you can see in the RFA. So they're asked to look at, what's the risk reward here? You know, wow, this seems very, you know, speculative, and we're unsure. There's a little preliminary data there, but we're really worried. However, if this really works, it'd be a major advance in the field. Okay? And that's the discussion we want the panel to have. Second one is qualifications of the project personnel, adequate facilities, project management. You know, are you really set up to get this done? Now, for qualifications, you know, I want you to think of this as a pass-fail element. It's really not a barrier for new faculty. We just want to see that you are able to do this kind of work. Do you have the qualifications to do this kind of work? Doesn't matter if you're a fellow of the Soil Science Society. What matters is, do you have some experience in soil physics? Does it relate to, you know, have you published a little there? Do you look like you're capable of getting this done? One of the other things here that sometimes trips people up is awareness of previous or alternative approaches, things related to pitfalls and limitations. You can't pretend that your approach is perfect. Don't pretend that your approach is perfect and that your methods are perfect. You need to be frank about areas where this might work and actually suggest what you would do if this doesn't work out. For larger projects, ones that require a management plan, you need to look at the requirements for management plans and take that seriously. Take that seriously on these larger grants that require one, and make sure that you're meeting what was asked for there as far as the skills for managing a larger project. Institutional experience and competence is one of the areas that we ask for. This is not only a track record of some experience at your institution, but also where we look for the commitment by your institution to support a particular activity. For a routine research application, that's not so important. This gets important for the larger grants that we make key criteria. Adequate facilities and administration and instrumentation. So facilities and instrumentation. Again, sometimes this intimidates folks from smaller institutions, and they say, you know, I'm at tiny state U, and I know enormous state U has so much more of this. But really, it's kind of a pass-fail thing. If what you're proposing only requires one greenhouse, it doesn't matter if your institution only has one or 100. Is there one? Does it work? Do you have access to it? Is it committed to this project? That's enough to get it done. Third is project relevance. Project relevance to U.S. agriculture is how it's expressed. However, project relevance to U.S. agriculture is defined by the program priorities in the request for application. So again, this gets back to what's in the request for application. What was the priority that the program asked for? Now, it'll be generally to yield improvements in U.S. agriculture, but read those specific priorities in there, and you need to have your application addressing those priorities. You know, many times we'll have folks call us and they say, hey, I want to do this kind of thing. Where would it fit? Where would it fit? That's sort of like, I got the square peg, and which round hole might this fit into? You really need to start the other way. Explore the applications. Think about what skills you have, what cooperatives you have on your campus, where you might be able to meet the goals of that program exactly. Now, I said that they're going to evaluation criteria will differ, and they do for research projects, for integrated projects that are looking to combine research, education, and extension, fellowships. There's also smaller grants that AFRI makes related to equipment grants, seed grants, conference grants. They all have different evaluation criteria, and those are all in the request for applications. So what happens at the panel meeting? You know, everybody's turned in their things electronically. They've seen how everybody else has rated things. Now you come to the panel meeting. They're all around the table. They're going to get what we call is the chart, which is a summary of the reviews, ratings for every application. The chart that each panelist gets is different, and that any ratings for applications they have a conflict of interest with are blank. So they don't even get to see the ratings for anything that they have a conflict of interest with. So what happens is the primary reviewer, and each application is assigned a minimum of three. There's a primary, secondary, and a tertiary reviewer or reader. And they'll go through their evaluation in order. Any ad hoc reviews will be read as well and summarized. And if this is a resubmission, they're going to read the response to the last year's review. This is a real opportunity for you to show that you've taken the panel's words to heart and are getting back to them with an improved proposal. After that, after they've gone through that, there'll be an interactive panel discussion, and this can include the entire panel. The entire panel. Overall reading of these reviews and discussion will take about 15 minutes on average. 15 minutes. Okay. Once they're done with this discussion, they're going to rate your application in one of the following categories, one of the categories shown on the screen. You know, you want to be in outstanding. You may rank below outstanding. Then, after they've ranked your proposal the consensus category, they're going to prepare a panel summary, which will include the salient points from the whole panel's discussion of your application, and as well as the individual reviews. So what you get back in your review comments are the panel summary and the individual reviews. Now, sometimes this can be confusing to folks because they'll get reviews that. Sometimes what will happen is you get all excellent reviews from the individual reviews. But in the panel discussion, some flaw comes up, and now you're not funded. And the summary really talks about a flaw. And what the applicant will do is focus on, but I got all excellence. How can I not be funded? Look at the panel summary and see what else they talked about. Okay, the panel summary is going to have positive, negative aspects of your application and a synthesis comment about your application. Now, if you think about this, and the way this works, there'll actually be a wall with these categories in, like post-it notes up on the wall, or some folks run it with a spreadsheet that'll be projected on a screen. And each category will have a list of application numbers. And as they put these numbers up, they say who's ahead of who, who's higher, ranked higher or lower. The last day of panel is a chance to reconsider all these rankings. They revisit all the categories. Because, you know, when you start out, maybe you were kind of hard. Maybe the panel was kind of hard on those first few applications, or maybe they were too easy on those first applications, or maybe there was some later in the day where they were kind of tired and didn't really give it a full consideration it needed. So the last day is the day for re-ranking. The first check is to make sure that every application is in the correct category, and then they look actually at the ranking. You know, what's the number one proposal in outstanding, number two, number three? And probably the first quarter or so of applications are actually ranked numerically. And when we go to fund, we follow the numeric ranking. Other things that may happen for the ranked applications is a discussion of budgets and recommendations by the panel. They'll be looking for sort of excessive things. And generally, we are not too harsh in reviewing applications. However, if there's something where you had three priorities, the panel says, you know, the first two make this an outstanding application, but the third priority is so dependent on those two, we don't think that should be funded until the first two work. If that happens, we'll adjust your budget accordingly. The national program leader and panel manager make the decisions to fund eligible projects below the line. So what we're going to do is fund projects, you know, we thank the panel, they leave. Then the panel manager and the national program leader look at that ranking and they fund down that list. But there are set-aside funds for the Ag and Food Research Initiative for strengthening proposals. This is for less successful institutions and for new investigators. So you're in a strengthening institution if your institution has less than 17,500 enrolled students. That makes you small to mid-sized. Also, if you're in an EPSCoR state, our EPSCoR state list is in our RFA, take a look at it, because our EPSCoR list is based on success within our programs, not other agencies, so each agency has a different sort of EPSCoR list. The other things, if you're at a more minority-serving institutions, you can qualify. So that allows you to be funded from this set-aside pool. There's also a criteria for new investigators. So if you haven't received federal funding before and you're a new investigator, there's the option that they funded down the list and there's sort of a line and we're not funding anybody below the line from the regular pool. However, for those down the list from eligible institutions, we can fund them from this strengthening pool or we can pick up a new investigator. So there is a significant advantage, a competitive advantage, if you're one from an EPSCoR state, small to mid-sized institution, or you qualify as a new investigator. Now, based on the decisions that are reached for funding, the NPL and panel manager will pair a funding list that shows here's the awards, here's where they're going, here's how much money, and how they're actually spending all that money. There's a meeting with the division director and the assistant director, the next two levels of supervision up, to go over what they're funding to make sure that they're meeting their requirements to spend the strengthening money and meet those criteria that are actually set in the legislation for the ADFRE program. So we're meeting the requirements of the law. Okay, post-panel, what happens if you're declined, if your applications are declined? You're going to get an email from to the project director from the national program leader. You're going to get written reviews, panel summary, and a relative ranking. It's disappointing to do this, can be upsetting. You put them away, think about it for a while, think about the comments there, because a lot of people put in significant time reading your application. There was a discussion about it from some of the top folks across the country about your application. Think about what's on there. You may want to contact the national program leader who keeps notes during the panel discussion. Maybe they can have something from their notes that might help you with some insight about where you might go for your next steps. What you want to get is not the email. You want to get the phone call. Phone call says that you've been recommended for a grant. You've been recommended for a reward. You'll get your reviews, panel summary, and relative ranking, but then there's a whole series of paperwork that you have to do to finish out the award, and they'll get a package emailed to you about the requirements that you have to fill out to initiate the funding process. After the panel manager will provide the agency with a report on recommendations for program enhancement. Many times the panel will have a discussion about this. There'll be discussions about sort of what topic areas, you know, the science involved here, whether or not there's also discussion about the process, improvements for the panel process that we might do. There is an identification of hot topics. So are we funding anything here that might be groundbreaking, that might, you know, we might want to make a big deal out of that we're going to fund this time? And there's recommendations about who might be future panel managers or panelists for the program. The National Program Reviewer is going to work on the award administration. It's going to be feedback and consultation to folks who got declined. And there's going to be lots of reporting on performance. There'll be summaries provided of what was funded. They're looking for continually looking for success stories and highlights that are reported in a range of areas. You know, the national program leaders don't only just run the program and the panel process. They're also champions for ag research, education, and extension. Literally, we get opportunities weekly to report to folks like the White House and the Office of Scientific and Technology Policy, Science and Technology Policy, Office of Management and Budget, Congress, higher levels in USDA, every week. So we're always looking for something there. And there's also program communication and outreach that we do, which is like this session here today. Okay, now that you've been very patient to sit through all that on sort of how the process works, what are the tips for success that we can offer you? Well, let's go through some of those. How about a top 10 list? Let's do a top 10 list. I got to admit, I've stolen this from our national program leader, Mike O'Neill. So, a lot depends on your worldview. You know, this is how we see the National Institute of Food and Agriculture. This is how you see the National Institute of Food and Agriculture. Nice source of money that you can come up to. So, let's look at number 10 here. Submit on time. Submit on time. I mentioned that we don't take late applications. So how far in advance should you submit? A week? A day? An hour? A minute? 1 second? You'd be surprised how many people don't plan well enough in advance, and they're trying to make this process of submission work in under an hour. For larger audiences that we've done, we've actually had a little giveaway thing that we where people would admit that they've tried to submit 1 minute ahead of time. Just got to plan a little better than that. Why? You know, here's the Naval Observatory Master Clock. Here's the Grants.gov Master Clock. All right. You know, you can argue about, well, the systems weren't there, and my thing really wasn't 2 minutes late because I have this statement from some universities use middleware to submit to grants.gov, if you've ever heard about the Cayuse system. So people will say, I pushed the button on the Cayuse system at 5 minutes till. And it doesn't matter. What matters to us is when it's stamped by grants.gov. 9. Have a colleague review your application. Have them take a look at your proposal. Leave time before submitting to have your proposal read by a colleague for technical merit, technical review, somebody who knows your field, but also enough time for somebody to proofread it who's like, you know, where's that English major who catches every grammar error and punctuation error that's involved? You know, you can't just rely on spell check. It's very obvious the applications that just rely on spell check. For instance, I love the one application that we got to a plant genome program where there was a, you know, there's always those strange names of particular genes. right? Well, they ran spell check and quickly submitted. The name of the gene was changed to an expletive. Okay? So everybody reading this application said, well, we will isolate expletive. We will do this with expletive. We will then insert expletive. You know, you're just not going to get funded when that happens. Another thing you can do is work with colleagues to see if you can get copies of funded proposals. Now, we do have, I think, on our website, we got permission from one applicant, and if you go to the integrated area on our website, there is a funded application for an integrated proposal as an example. However, we usually don't release applications, and it because it contains proprietary information, and we just don't like to do it. It takes a FOIA request. So you really need to ask colleagues to see what they can share. And be sure to thank them for sharing, thank them for their time and helping take a look at your application. Number 8, write a meaningful and engaging project summary. Remember I told you that only 3 of those 20 panelists are going to be assigned your application and read the whole application. But most of the panel, all 20 of them, are going to read your project summary. They're going to read your project summary. So you really want it to tell a complete story. It needs to include the goals and objectives, highlights with what's new and creative, describes, you know, the outputs, outcomes, things that will happen with your application. Now, down at the bottom, we have the note for newbies. Newbies, cutting and pasting from your introduction is usually the road to failure on this. Okay, it really needs to be a work of art and stand on its own. It needs to be compelling. 7, write the proposal, write your application for the reviewers. You know, put yourselves in their shoes. You're a reviewer and you've got 15 or 20 applications, proposals you're going to pour through. Capture their attention. Be compelling. Get to the point. Be succinct. You know, what will be different about your project? What will be different as a result of your project? What's unique? What's really exciting about what you're going to do? How does this advance the field? For integrated projects where you're really looking to achieve an outcome, you need to describe how you're going to evaluate your success. If a letter of intent is required, be certain that you address the priorities listed in the program description. This is where you're going to get that, is a chance for you to check about being on target. You need to describe the salient points of your project, include key objectives, and define all necessary functions. So if this is an integrated program and you submit a letter of intent that's all about all the research you're going to do, you're going to get a discouraged letter back that says you've missed the point. Remember that the evaluation is going to be about how well your project is integrated between all these things. You want to identify the outcomes and outputs you're going to have, and you've got to follow the formatting guidelines. Follow the formatting guidelines. We ask you to submit these things in PDF format, and you're going to email them to us. What happens in our system to avoid viruses and all those kinds of things, if you send it to us in Microsoft Word format, it's scrubbed out of our system. Okay? We really need you to submit it in PDF format. A lot of the new versions of Microsoft Word have that in it. You know, you can save it as a PDF. Please do so. Now, remember that if you're resubmitting, there's these reviewer comments that you got, and you're going to modify your proposal, and you're going to resubmit. There is an advantage in that you get an extra page to redress the reviewer's comments. Take advantage of that and show the reviewers places in the proposal where you responded to their comments. However, if you disagreed with their particular comments, this is a chance for you to exercise your diplomatic skills. Okay? You don't want to say that obviously you got poor reviewers who didn't understand this area of science and were totally unaware of new techniques and my application was the best. What you want to do is say that, you know, we appreciate the comments that the reviewers provided, and we have responded by, you know, look here and there. We, you know, if they criticize the method and you're going to stick with it, you need to say that, well, you know, justify this and say, you know, we took a second look at our methods, but based on and throw in a couple of references, you know, these recent results, we're sticking with our method. We think it's appropriate in this institute because, you know, take advantage of that. Number six, if you're submitting a larger application that includes a team, you need to take the time to explain the role that each team member will have. You know, who's responsible for what in the large project. If the project involves extension, it's critical to decide and identify who the stakeholders are that you're going to be dealing with. And what roles they play in the development of the project and the implementation. And for extension, there's always the idea that you're going to provide knowledge out to folks and they're going to implement it. Well, a key part of this is evaluating, did they implement that? Were they successful implementing that knowledge? And that's where a lot of applications fall down. So you've got to have folks... on the team. This is time for the intermission. You know, you can take a break here, think about what you might, what your experience was with applications, daydream about money you might receive, all those good kinds of things. But break's over, okay? Let's talk about number five here. Develop a project outline. This holds even for research applications. You know, think about, you know, single investigator research applications. Think about what you're going to be doing, but it's critical for larger applications for integrated projects. So if it's a $10 million project that we're asking for, you need to think about goals and objectives, critical project functions, who is going to be on the team and how they're going to work together and what their responsibilities are. For integrated projects, they're going to do research, education, and extension. You know, you're going to generate some new knowledge. Education, you're really talking not about, gee, we're going to have some grad students on this grant. No, it's really about curriculum development and those sorts of things. There's also one of the key things we look for in education, funding education activities, is that they will establish something that's carried on past the duration of the grant, the extension part, again, will be putting knowledge into action on the ground, and the role of stakeholders there, again, is the key. Now, if you're assembling this large team, you've got to have a timeline for completing your application. You know, so when's the deadline for submission? Start working back. How much time will your contracts or grants office take? Some offices are saying 2 weeks, some 1 week. Some a month, about, you know, depending on how complex it is for all the signatures. So how much time, you know, for review is in there? The key here is, you know, start early. Start early. Don't be trying to walk it through the day it's due. Okay. If you're putting together a large team, it helps to ask your team members to develop a couple of PowerPoint slides. Give them a two or three slide template and say, okay, what are you going to do? How's it connect to other things that we're going to do? And what are you going to need to really do this so that you can see how all the pieces will come together and the shape of those pieces? Talk about number four. Tip number four is goals and objectives in your application. It should really be clear, what's the point of funding the project? You know, What's going to be different here? What are you really going to do? What's really compelling about this? Why should the panel care about what you're proposing? Around this main goal, you should have supporting objectives so that there are functions and activities that should be defined that clearly relate to this overall goal. And it's not just a bunch of sort of things that, hey, we'd like to work on these things. We've always worked on these things. we'll write a bunch of papers, and wouldn't that be great? Gee, maybe I'll get tenure, but it really doesn't come together. You've got to show the panel that it's going to come together. Number three. Got to assemble this effective team and develop the application together. You got to include all the necessary expertise right up front for the project. You don't start writing until you get all the team together. You've seen those slides, and you need to share the responsibility for writing, but edit it into a single voice. This is some of the worst things that we see, particularly for integrated projects, are really their research projects, and somebody went down to the hall to their buddy in extension and said, "Hey, if we gave you $10,000, could you do a website on this for us?" "Sure." "Okay." And that's what's kind of tacked on. Or, "Hey, add this to field day." "Yeah, okay." "Oh, you'll hold a stakeholder workshop session or something." "Yeah, no problem." No, you really need to have people working together on things and share the responsibility and link this back to the outcome that you're looking for. Number two. Serve on a panel. This will give you the best insight of all to the review process. You can email to us at newreviewer@nifa.usda.gov. Include a two-page CV is good. Remember that you can't serve on a panel that you're submitting an application to, so don't even try that. In addition to emailing to our database, remember our database currently has about 50,000 names in it. 50,000 names. Right? We're going to use 1,000 people. 1,000 people on a panel. Sounds like a lot, you know, of people in our database. Why would we need new reviewers? But you got to remember that by the time you start parsing down for what's needed, okay, I'm setting up a bioenergy panel. All right. I need somebody who has expertise on miscanthus, right? Out of those 50,000 people in our database, how many people do you think know miscanthus? All right? Maybe 20? 30? All right? Maybe 100? I'm lucky, it's 100. Then I have to look. Remember all those criteria? I need variety by institution type, stage of career, geography, all those things. So that starts to throw out more and more of them. And I'm down to just a few people that I have to call to see if I can get them to serve on the panel. So it seems like a long shot to be on a panel, but it's really not, depending on how targeted your expertise is to a particular panel's needs. I would recommend not only that you send your CV in to this new reviewer database, but if you're very interested in a program, you call the NPL or email them and say, "I'm available this year to serve on the panel." Now, you need to check beforehand, because here's what's going to happen for panel service. It's going to come at the worst possible time for you. The worst possible time. You're going to have to have enough time to read those 20 applications, like 40 hours at least, right? Over a three-week period, four-week period, you're going to have a week of time dedicated to read all those applications. You're going to have to be able to accept our offer of travel to Washington, D.C. for a week, right? So now that's another week where you're going to be away. And during that time, you've got to get relief from your teaching duties or whatever things, you know, finals are coming up, or, you know, you have committee assignments on campus or other things. You've got to be able to get free for that. However, if your department chair or your dean should understand that this is a key to building, this is a key investment in you and your grantsmanship skills to serve on this panel. So you need to work with them as well to say, "Hey, I'm going to try and get on a panel, and will we be able to cover for me when I'm gone that week?" So get them on the bandwagon on that. The number one tip. Read the request for applications. We spend a lot of time working on the request for applications. A lot of time. It represents stakeholder input from literally hundreds of different groups and individuals. commodity groups, scientific organizations, efforts by Congress, legislatively mandated advisory committees, technical advisory committees, and review boards, reports from the National Academy of Sciences. A lot has gone into developing what's in the RFA. A lot of thought has gone into shaping the evaluation criteria. A lot of thought has gone into funding levels. What will it take to get this done? There are some things that, you could debate how much thought has gone into it because it's decided by Congress. Congress decides eligibility. You see a program that you're interested in, look at the eligibility for that program. You may not be eligible. The Ag and Food Research Initiative has very broad eligibility. Colleges and universities, at least for single function work, college and universities, 501c3s, businesses, corporations, even individuals are eligible for single function AFRI grants. However, when it comes to integrated grants, grants that combine some aspect of research, education, and extension, it has to be a degree-granting college or university. The single function broad eligibility, federal laboratories eligible. Let's see. Deadlines. Pay attention to those deadlines and the project requirements. So in summary, here's the 10 tips all at once. It takes some time to think about those things and really get them in shape. Think about aspects of these. The number 9, have a colleague review your proposal. Sometimes it works to get with on campus, see what kind of resources are available on campus, what you can do on campus. Think about teaming up with folks, sort of developing a partnership with people to work together on, develop sort of the wingman concept where you can help each other with proposals and applications, those kinds of things. Share information about upcoming workshops like this or other activities that might be of help to you. What we'll do now is we'll talk about a couple of our RFAs that have just recently come out. First one will be about the Ag and Food Research Initiative RFA related to climate variability, and Dr. Cavallaro will speak on that one.
Good morning. Yes. So the RFA that's out now for the climate, what used to be climate change is now climate variability and change challenge area. There wasn't an announcement in 2011. We sort of rolled the 2011 and 2012 together. So this is the announcement. So it's coming out earlier than usual, but way late for 2011. NPL, that sort of lead for the whole challenge area, is Dr. Michael Bowers. And there's his picture and number and contact information. As an overview, we announced it. I think it came out about a month ago, I guess, and to solve critical agricultural issues, priorities, or problems of climate change through the integration of research, education, and extension activities. So I think the whole RFA, if I'm not mistaken, is pretty much asking for integrated proposals of one kind or another. The agriculture and natural resources science for climate variability and change, that's a very long title, that's why I'm stumbling here, will fund projects focused on reducing greenhouse gas emissions and increasing carbon sequestration in agricultural and forest systems, and that includes range, and preparing the nation's agriculture and forest to adapt to a changing climate. So one of the things about adapting to a changing climate, sort of understanding what might be expected. So in your particular area, don't get it wrong. If it's predicted to be a lot drier, you know, don't talk about too much rain, I guess. Although variability is probably the key aspect in any area. So the majority of these grants will be integrated, transdisciplinary projects. focused on developing advanced food, feed, and fiber production systems and new plant cultivars and animal breeds adapted to changing climates through various methods, and developing the best management practices and sustainability methods to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and to increase our carbon sequestration and contribute to emerging carbon-based markets. So there's some economics involved in some of this as well. The projects are expected to address one of the stated priority areas, and that collectively contribute to the achievement of the following goals: adaptation, mitigation, and climate education and extension. So we want to increase the number of scientists, educators, and extension professionals in the workforce, and increase their skills and knowledge to address climate change problems. We want to reduce the main mitigation thing we're focused on is reducing greenhouse gas emissions, but there's some water issues involved, because obviously changing climate will involve changing water budgets, and adaptation to maximize resiliency and reduce the impact of changing climate on our production systems. So water footprint, nitrogen footprint, and carbon as well. For FY12, this challenge area encourages proposals with interests that cut across and integrate different agricultural and natural resource systems, especially those that are of major importance to the U.S. economy, the U.S. environment, or global food security, and that address specific objectives that are in the RFA. More specifically, the areas or systems to be emphasized in 2012 could include, but are not limited to, food and fiber production systems, including legume production, aquaculture systems, forest systems, forage and range systems, and animal production systems, including ruminant, swine, and poultry production. Now, these sort of basically commodities, if you will, were outlined in the 2010 RFA. And forward to 2011 and 2012, I projected to 2011 and 12. So 11 and 12 are combined in this one. The challenge areas are regional approaches to climate change, and these are coordinated agricultural projects. These are those big, complicated proposals that you ought to start submitting a week ahead, for sure, because they can be very large and take a lot of time to upload, and I've heard problems of systems crashing and moving to another computer and systems crashing, et cetera. So it can take a long time to submit those. And integrated approaches to climate adaptation and mitigation and natural resource systems. So those are the two main areas. There's also, we have joint program with NSF called Water Sustainability and Climate. This has approximately $20 million, $5 million coming from the AFRI program, and the other 15 coming from NSF sources. And the proposals will be submitted to NSF. So it will go through the NSF Fastlane system, and the deadline is October 19th, so coming right up. You're probably not going to run out and write such a proposal right now. So hopefully you've already heard about this. The information is at the NIFA and NSF websites both. The program leader for NIFA is Marianne Rossum, and I'm helping her out there. So there's also coming up, just recently approved, I believe, or on the verge of getting the final signature, is the second round of what we call the Earth System Modeling Program. We did that last year, and you can look at the RFA from last year. There's not any major changes for this year, and this is a lot. This has to do with modeling systems that integrate the whole Earth system. In other words, you know, if you want to include agriculture, crop models included in the general circulation models and climate models. So the program funds for that are approximately $40 million. Again, only $5 million is coming from AFRI, and the other $35 from NSF. And again, these proposals will be submitted to NSF. So look for that announcement. It will be up on the NSF website, and hopefully soon thereafter, if not simultaneously, on our website. So, closing comments. Why are we on closing comments?
Oh, that's for business.
Oh, okay. Sorry. So this challenge area focuses on societal challenges to mitigate and adapt to climate change. The specific program areas are designed to achieve long-term outcome for reducing the use of energy, nitrogen, water, and production in the production of food, fiber, and fuel, and to increase carbon sequestration. In other words, low carbon budget and preserve our natural resources. The project types are multifunction, integrated research, education, and extension projects, and these phase grants, in other words, the sort of strengthening grants, are also accepted in this program. This is a general contact information. Again, Michael Bowers is the lead. And now, this is the regional approaches to adaptation mitigation. Specifically, the lead for this part of this challenge area is Ray Knighton, and his contact information is, he's actually at the meetings here. You might see him around if you recognize that face. So the regional approaches to, these are the big CAP grants that I spoke of. They will be due in January, but there's a letter of intent that's required in October, this month, i.e., towards the end of this month on the 28th. We're talking about $2 million per year, so we've reduced it a little bit from last year. Last year it was a $5 million per year limit. So it's a regional integrated coordinated agricultural project. So it brings together multi-state, multi-institutional, and transdisciplinary team, and it has to be integrated. It involves a team that conducts work targeted on at least two of the three functions of research, education, and extension. Last year, we required all three. A CAP contains the needed science-based expertise in all those areas that are presented, all those functions that are presented. And the application should outline potential for the project, the structure, coordination plan, implementation plan. This is one of the kinds that requires an implementation plan, and that it better be a good implementation plan, because that's often just sort of what decides the number three from number four project ranking. So the priorities are food and fiber production systems, and that includes legume production, aquaculture systems, forest systems, forage and range, and animal production systems, that including ruminant, swine, and poultry production. Last year it was just swine and poultry, and so this year we're really emphasizing ruminants. And again, last year grains were emphasized, and so this year we're emphasizing legumes. And so that in general, the emphasis will be given to the projects types that and commodities that were not funded last year. So other program requirements: you have to have applications from collaborations with minority serving institutions are strongly encouraged, and this is basically for any project as well. A national conference is encouraged. Educational components should focus on enhancing formal classroom introduction instruction. We're not talking about just putting a graduate student on the project. Evaluation of educational activities or interventions must be budgeted for. You don't just do it, you have to evaluate how you've done. Extension activities should enable individuals and groups to make informed decisions. And other requirements, education's activities should include, and this basically applies to any education function grant for us, increased capacity of agricultural programs to meet the teaching and research demands for the future, in this case brought about by climate change, climate variability and change. And so we're talking about faculty development, teaching methods, workshops, collaborative efforts, networking, etc. Develop and provide structured research training and academic programs. Synthesize and incorporate a wide range of the latest developments in research, and lead to measurable, and this is very important, this is part of the evaluation, lead to measurable documented changes in learning actions and conditions in audience and stakeholder group. More program requirements, the extension, as far as extension goes, you should conduct the programs that deliver science-based knowledge and informal education programs, enabling practical decision-making, include program delivery that may range from community-based, national, and from face-to-face electronic and or any combinations of that, synthesize and incorporate a wide range of the latest research results. It should lead to measurable documented changes. Again, an evaluation should be done or planned for. Obviously, you can't do it until you've done and demonstrate the adoption of approaches and practices across the region and document economic and social acceptance and or implications for individuals, regions, funding agencies, et cetera, of this change. The general milestones to be achieved in this kind of project within the lifetime of the project is to develop fundamental function, develop and implement a functional network of monitoring sites, and we're talking about carbon, water, nitrogen, and production. Develop standardized methodologies, so the methodology should be well documented by the end and evaluated. Establish current baselines. That's kind of needed right at the beginning. First off, you'll need some baselines, or you may already have the baselines for carbon fluxes, energy, nitrogen, and water, and a suite of existing and or novel approaches and management practices to lead to this net decrease in the footprints for these resources, and conduct a comprehensive life cycle analysis. And this doesn't have to be an EPA-defined life cycle analysis, but there's some pretty well-defined procedures now in life cycle analysis. So if you want to do this, and you don't have anyone experienced in life cycle analysis, get someone, because it's an important point that brings you down in the rankings. Integrated approaches. Now, these would be the standard grants, and Diana Jerkins will be the lead on that, and here's her contact information. So this one has a letter of intent deadline due really coming right up this Friday. Yes, that's right. And then the deadline, so that's required. You have to submit a letter of intent, and it's you'll get the results back, and you can apply if you've submitted your letter of a grant by letter of intent by December 16th. Proposed budgets must not exceed $750,000. Now, last year, I don't know if you noticed or you saw last year's, we were giving $1 million per year. These are definitely scaled back from last year because of budget cuts. These are all, they all must be integrated projects. Anything exceeding, you could have also a conference grant. And phase grants are also allowed for this. So the applicants must address the following research projects. They must demonstrate well-developed plan for achieving reduction in agricultural emissions and an increase in carbon sequestration in agroecosystems. That's the mitigation part. Or increase in resiliency and sustainability of the production system under variable climates, and that would be the adaptation side. So those are the sort of overall goals. The research priorities then are to develop or improve management options for adaptation or mitigation in soil carbon sequestration and storage, under changing land cover, land use practices, sustainable joint use of nitrogen and water to optimize yield and quality, and integration of coupled climate agricultural models and technologies into decision support tools. And these are pretty much the same as last year's. More priorities are to develop and improve models and technologies for climate mitigation, forecast and control of pest, disease, and invasive species outbreaks under climate change, system-level analysis to allow targeted and predictable breeding strategies, and applications of classical and conventional breeding or new technologies to utilize recent advances in genomic sequence information, again, for adaptation and mitigation purposes. And finally, I think these are the last ones, develop or improve knowledge of how human behavior, decision, and choices affect carbon, nitrogen, and water, and impacts of alternative strategies for mitigation and adaptation on the prosperities of small to medium farms, and local and regional national barriers for adoption of on-farm technologies that would mitigate climate change or reduce the impact or the footprints on energy, nitrogen, carbon, and water. So the education priorities are to develop human capital relevant to AFRI climate change program or climate variability and change program. They have to address one or more of the specific education priorities, and they must include faculty development, curriculum development, instructional materials and equipment, and innovative teaching methodologies to address climate change. Furthermore, the specific priorities are to increase capacity of agricultural programs to meet teaching demands brought about by climate change, and improve teaching methods, workshops, and collaborative efforts in networking, as well as within the traditional agricultural disciplines. And transdisciplinary curricula are emphasized, and to develop and provide structured research, training, and academic programs for undergraduate and graduate students for increased capacity in cross-disciplinary agriculture and research. The extension priorities, they must deliver science-based knowledge and information to various communities, i.e. stakeholders, and they must address program-specific priorities to enable individuals and groups to make appropriate decisions on production and consumption. So the specific priorities here are develop materials and outreach programs to raise youth and adult awareness, develop appropriate training and resource materials for extension educators, and develop educational materials and outreach programs in collaboration with groups such as eExtension, 4-H, Agriculture in the Classroom, or similar youth-type programs. So other program requirements, they must adhere to eligibility, form applications from collaborations with minority-serving institutions, as we said before. And if it's funded, you would be expected to coordinate with an appropriate, if there is an appropriate, CAP program that's been funded in this program. So Sustainable Bioenergy, Mark Poth will talk about that. He leads that group.
Well, congratulations. You've survived a really long series of presentations. I'm going to try and step through this one pretty quickly, and then really the remainder of our time is available for you to have discussions with our staff about any particular program that you might be interested in, specific questions you may have about the process of applying, and all that good kind of stuff. So let's step through the Sustainable Bioenergy Portfolio. Bioenergy is supported by a number of different programs within the National Institute of Food and Agriculture. AFRI offers opportunities. There's the Biomass Research and Development Initiative. There's the SEEP program and Feedstock Genomics, which is run in conjunction with DOE. Let's talk about AFRI, and we'll provide some details on that related to bioenergy. It's really about the sustainable production of bioenergy, biopower, and bio-based products from dedicated energy crops. To do this, you really have to approach it regionally because the systems are different region by region. We're looking to incorporate questions, overcome issues related to logistics, marketing and distribution, have an analysis and decision tools available to see how well is this really working economically, environmentally, et cetera. And we, of course, need to have processes going on to train the workforce. Now, the challenge area programs include one related to regional approaches to feedstock production, as well as research to answer critical questions that will make biofuel production work, bioenergy production work. We're offering a large cap. This is a $10 million grant, $2 million a year, to really work on one of these regional approaches. It's looking at a coordinated plan to look at developing biofuels, production of biomass for biofuel production. This would be advanced biofuels, not ethanol. We're looking for multidisciplinary, transdisciplinary approaches that leverage existing resources to do this. And it should use one of the feedstocks that's identified within our request for applications. Other requirements, you need to look at all the submission information that we've gone over previously. We're looking for collaborations or applications really from minority serving institutions. And you must address all aspects of the supply chain as defined and described in the request for applications. So it has to be a complete package kind of application. That would include feedstock development, production systems associated with that particular feedstock, logistics, how you're going to handle the stuff that you produce, and system performance. The lead for this is Dr. Bill Goldner, and his contact information is right here, or if you just search for him on our website, he'll show up. Now, we do have a portfolio of research programs here to look at key elements that actually a recent report by the National Research Council related to biofuels identified several of these as areas where we just don't know what the influence will be on establishing a biofuel production system in the nation. So we're offering research grants related to policy for biofuel production. We want to know about the impacts. National Research Council talked about biodiversity. We want to focus on effects on pollinators and wildlife. We're also interested in socioeconomic impacts in rural communities of shifts to biofuel production and questions related to land use change. If we're going to use marginal lands for biofuel feedstock production, how is that going to influence things? Here's the details on the policy options. It's really standard grants at $350,000 per year for 2 to 4 years. That's run by Dr. Fenn Hunt, and there's her contact information. Effects on wildlife and pollinators. This is $500,000 per year for project over 2 to 4 years. And we'll also support all of these. We support the phase grants, the strengthening grants. That's described in the RFA. Those are available to small to mid-sized institutions, EBSCOR states, and minority-serving institutions. Oops, I skipped Dr. Cassidy, who's the key contact for that. Socioeconomic impacts, again, $350,000 per year. And the contact is Dr. Fenn Hunt. Land use change, $500,000 per year for projects of 2 to 4 years. And that's run by Dr. Cavallaro, who's here today. She can answer questions about that particular program. Again, the warnings for our grants that you have to adhere to all the requirements for submission as they are described in the RFA. Encourage collaboration with minority-serving institutions. And you have to link to one of the regional bioenergy systems for your particular research project. Just a brief word about the Biomass Research and Development Initiative. It makes grants of up to $7 million for biomass research and development. It also supports demonstration projects. The pre-application deadline was in August. You had to have gone through that pre-app process to be eligible for the application deadline here coming up in December. However, depending on what happens with the farm bill, we may be offering this bill again. Congress is working on the farm bill. We'll see how this particular program survives. Total funding available from this program this coming year will be $50 million. Small business innovation research also supports bioenergy. Eligibility here is limited to small businesses, but university faculty can partner with the small business and get grants sort of in two steps. First is a phase one grant, which is kind of proof of concept, and then a phase two commercialization grant of up to $350,000. This brings us to the AFRI foundational programs, which are about the basic science that's supported in our agency, the fundamental science. And Dr. Cavallaro will step you through those quickly, and then we'll go to our discussion period.
All right, so there's quite a few slides in here. I tried to give more information on the programs I thought would be more relevant to y'all, but they're all mentioned here. So the AFRI programs includes those five challenge areas, but also there's this foundational programs, and those are designed to build a foundation of knowledge in fundamental and applied food and agricultural sciences critical for solving the current and future societal issues. So they could solve issues that aren't within the challenge areas, but also within the challenge areas at a more fundamental level. So the major program areas covered in the foundational programs RFA were those that were mandated in the 2008 Farm Bill? I think it was 2008 came out. So those were defined as plant health and production and plant products, animal health and production and animal products, food safety, nutrition and health, renewable energy, natural resources and environment, agricultural systems and technology, and ag economics in rural communities. So the plant health and production has several sort of sub-programs within it. There were $23 million available for 2011. We hope to have the same amount available for 2012. The RFA for 2012 is not developed yet, as you saw on the previous slide. So actually, it's under development, so there is a small window of opportunity for you all to react to the 2011 RFA if you want to, and send the appropriate program leader comments, or you can also send it to our general mailbox for comments on our RFAs. So anyway, the areas are biology of agricultural plants. This is quite broad. Dr. Sheng Liang Shu Lin is in charge of that one, and it involves genomics, molecular and cellular genetics, plant technology, conventional breeding, plant response to pests and pathogens, mechanisms to environmental stress, and improved nutrient qualities. There's also understanding plant-associated microorganisms. Some of you may have recall a previous program in plant microbe associations, and this is similar to that. May address pathogenic or beneficial, and the interactions may be physical or chemical. Oh, misspelled that. Epidemiological studies are also allowed here, and they must focus on bacteria, oomycetes, fungi, or viruses. Third program within this is controlling weedy and invasive species. Again, this used to be a more standalone program. Dr. Michael Bowers will be running that, and it's recognizing issues with weeds as well as other types of invasive species, pest management, and how to manage and predict invasive species. I think this is the last one. The Insects and Nematodes program, Mary Purcell Miramontes is running that one on signaling mechanisms, communication between pests, biological agents, pollinators, ecological and chemical and genetic interactions. Research that will be applied to ecologically based management programs and transgenic technologies to limit severity of insect pests. By making them unable to transmit. So there are various mechanisms involved there. So the next area mandated by Congress is animal health production and animal products. So we have the animal reproduction That's about $20 million. Animal reproduction, improved nutritional performance, growth and lactation of animals, and animal health and disease. So I won't go through much of that because not as much relevance here. Food safety, nutrition and health, physical and molecular mechanisms of food contamination, function and efficacy of nutrients, and improved processing technology. So probably the first one, there may be some interest there in this among the society. So finally, there's more after this. So the renewable energy, natural resources, and environment program is $9 million last year. Again, we hope to have at least that much for 2012. The overall goal is to fund a portfolio of research projects that improve our understanding of linkages among processes and management actions at diverse. So we're interested in diverse temporal scales, diverse spatial scales, and sustaining ecosystems and supporting natural resources in those systems. We're also talking about a portfolio, so we will probably be emphasizing areas that were not funded in 2011, in terms of, but not exclusively. So this past year, and all these programs are already done, and decisions are being made currently. So this past year, what we had, and we hope to continue similar priority areas this year, are processes and transformation in air, water, and soil. So this is a sort of more fundamental, but it does include some applied sciences, physical, chemical, biogeochemical, molecular, and microbiological process all involved. Thresholds in agro ecosystems, and this is one that might lead into something to do with climate change or bioenergy, land use change, etc., but the idea is environmental, social, and economic controls of critical environmental thresholds. So are our systems approaching, or are they likely to approach some threshold that will cause an abrupt change in the system or threaten the agro-ecosystem integrity entirely? And then finally, what we had was management in agroecosystems. And this one, more applied management, development of innovative management practices, including all these things listed here. But they must address socioeconomic and behavioral barriers to adoption of new practices that might improve productivity, especially under changing conditions. And changing policies as well. So agricultural systems and technology is another area. Emphasis is on the interrelationships between system components and distinct disciplines. And so a whole slew of different disciplines might be involved, but it has to be sort of interdisciplinary. And that's the emphasis here on agricultural systems. Engineering products and processes, that's going to be led by Dr. Peter Johnson. And that will be to improve agriculturally relevant plant, animal, and forestry systems, enable computing and information systems to manage and interpret geospatial information relevant to the issue, and contribute to improved animal welfare through enhanced alternatives and refine agricultural and forestry systems that balance economic, environmental, and social. So again, this is pretty really complete systems type of program. The other aspect to this technology is the nanotechnology. That's a field that we've had a program in for probably about 5 or 6 years now, maybe more. Anyway, so it's focus on nanotechnology enabled solutions to food security problems, climate change mitigation, nutritional quality, etc., and also environmental quality, biodiversity, and early detection of issues coming up, responsible applications, risk management, and evaluation in both production and processing applications. So then, finally, I think this is the last area, agriculture, economics, and rural communities. Primary goal is to promote sustainable agriculture and rural development, defined to include to satisfy human food, feed, and fiber needs, contribute to biofuel product needs, enhance environmental quality and resource base, sustain economic viability, and enhance the quality of life for farmers and rural farm workers and rural communities. We also have small and medium-sized, within that we have small and medium-sized farms program, entrepreneurship and small business development, rural development, markets and trade, and environment. State of Energy Extension Partnership, I think that's yours, yes?
Yes.
Okay, so Mark Poth will take it from here. We're almost done.
This is where you can tell that we made this presentation by stitching together other stuff. So this was covered in, I talked about this briefly in the summary of the bioenergy programs. This one really looks to promote energy efficiency and is done in partnership with DOE. Actually, this last time it was offered, all the funding came from DOE. We just worked closely with them on the structure of their funding. It's part of our role at the National Institute of Food and Agriculture to lure other more wealthy agencies into funding stuff related to agriculture. Remember, we only have, it sounds like a lot of money at NIFA, it sounds like $1 billion. But compared to people like DOE or NIH, who has like $30 billion, you know, we're kind of small potatoes. So a lot of our effort goes into working with them on areas of common interest and seeing if we can get them to spend more of their money on things that really work to help us achieve our goals too. Well, common goals, I should say. This one really looks at working on energy efficiency, looks to partner extension with state energy offices and fund that to try and get something going to help meet energy efficiency. And let's see. If you're interested in particulars about this program, you can contact me, and there's my contact information. But I'm on the website too, so.